Okay, maybe it's time to start. Hello and welcome everyone. Welcome to today's policy in practice seminar that, as you know, we at the School of Public Policy arrange. Our team at the School of Public Policy, including my colleague Vanessa and Jemima, we co-host this seminar series. And today it's my pleasure to host and introduce Hugh Cole, who is very well known to the FPP. Hugh has had a wonderful career straddling across different sectors, having worked in the nonprofit sector, in the academia, on the frontier of research and policy, and now at the coalface of policy, working inside government. He also has had a strong connection with School of Public Policy. He was and still is one of our own, an executive MPA, and did very well in the program, as you read. He has worked in Oxfam for a long time and other agencies. He was also my colleague at the International Growth Center, which many of you know is a joint LSE-Oxford Center that aims at promoting growth in developing countries, basically Africa and Asia, based on ideas generated from frontier research. And Hugh was the guy who was directly dealing with countries in Asia and Africa, dealing with policymakers on both the demand and supply side of evidence. And then he left to join the city of Cape Town, where he's director of policy and strategy, leading a large team that does data analysis, analytical work, and all kinds of other like research support and all kinds of other work that directly feeds into policy. In fact, Hugh is also not new to this seminar series. He was our first speaker at this seminar series 2 years ago. So he is also not new to the format, to the student, to the school, and knows very well the objectives of the series also. So today, Hugh will be talking about infrastructure challenges, something that is hugely important for all of us. The challenge there is, how do you have public policy, analytical frameworks, empirical evidence feed into infrastructure planning and implementation and evaluation? And City of Cape Town, many of you would perhaps know, has been at the frontier of, call it innovative thinking, both challenges, but also innovative thinking on policy issues, and a lot of that credit should go to Hugh. So with these words, no pressure, over to you, Hugh. So as usual, Hugh will speak for, I don't know, 40 to 45 minutes. We'll have enough time for your questions and answers. You should get ready with your questions, and we'll then open up for questions and answers.
Thank you, Anand. Thank you. It's a very kind and generous introduction. And it is always a pleasure to see my former colleague Adnan and to interact with colleagues from the LSE. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm not going to present it straight away. I have slides that I'm going to speak to, but I'll just give a brief introduction to myself while I get those up. So as Adnan said, my role in the City of Cape Town is Director of Policy and Strategy. So I sit in the center of the organization, so to speak. So I'm structurally in corporate services. So I have a transversal function, and my team is made up of a strategic policy team, a strategic planning team, an economic analysis team, and a research team. And we work with functions across the organization. So this piece of work, and the first thing I should say is normally when people who are talking about infrastructure are often either engineers or spatial planners, and I'm neither of those. But I worked very closely with both of those disciplines and others in this piece of work, which will come through, I hope. So why, when I was in touch with Adnan about a seminar series, why did I think that this topic was important and interesting? So I think clearly, we just need to look at the major bills just being passed in the United States to know that infrastructure is a key part of post-COVID recovery, and of addressing some of the major challenges we face globally. We know that cities are critical to our greatest global challenges, whether it be climate change, reducing poverty, addressing inequality. Cities will be central to all of those global challenges. And, one of the great kind of urban economists often says, there's no, to quote him loosely, he says, there's no path to progress or prosperity that does not pass through city streets. But achieving those, the potential of cities to bring transformative change and to be vehicles of human development and innovation and low carbon development, infrastructure is absolutely critical to enabling all of those. Even just the most basic function of making sure that you bring clean water into a city and take waste out is highly dependent on infrastructure. But it's technically complex. It's financially complex. But I think probably relevant for this audience as well, it's organizationally and politically complex as well. So I hope that by looking at this particular case study, and I hope that you'll see it as a case study, it's very much still a work in progress, we'll be able to explore some of those issues together in the Cape Town context. And this piece of work started very much out of the COVID response in Cape Town. We had a whole of organization approach to COVID when it was clear that it was gonna impact South Africa as much as it was impacting the rest of the world in sort of February last year. And we really ran hard at focusing on the response to COVID as a city government. But then towards the end of last year, recognized that we started to shift into a recovery mode and thinking about how we could support recovery from the devastating economic impact of COVID. And it became, it was clear that infrastructure would play a critical part in that. And when this piece of work was initiated, when a few of us had a conversation and said, look, we need to galvanize an infrastructure, a big push on infrastructure. I had in mind that it might end up being a set of projects, and many infrastructure strategies, including in South Africa, end up being lists of sort of projects, like sort of the president's presidential priority projects or something like that. And it worked out quite differently, because the more we got into it, the more we realized how systemically complex it was to get infrastructure to support infrastructure delivery and with sound analysis over time. So you'll see that much of what we ended up doing was building a system that we will use in the years going forward to drive infrastructure delivery. So that's the context. Let me dive in with a little bit of so in terms of what I want to cover in this presentation, I will move quite quickly through some sections just to protect the time for discussion. I want to cover a little bit of context for those who don't know South Africa and Cape Town. I want to give some examples of sort of generalized infrastructure delivery challenges. I want to look at a particular case around wastewater just to illustrate some of the challenges. And then just talk about this, it's not a very snappy name. We originally called it an infrastructure strategy, but for various reasons, we ended up calling it a planning and delivery framework. And then ending up with some lessons. So context, the city of Cape Town is part of local government in South Africa. There are three spheres of government: national, provincial, and local. It's an independent sphere of government. So we don't speak about tiers of government in South Africa. It's an independent spheres of government. It has an elected council that approves policies and bylaws and strategies for implementation by officials. And it has a broad range of powers and functions. The executive mayor has significant powers and functions, and the city government has revenue raising potential. So it's quite different from US cities, for example, but we are able to raise property taxes and generate rates and tariffs from the sale of water, the provision of services, basically water, electricity, waste collection, etc. But we do also receive grants from national government and a portion of the national tax revenues that are brought in. The budget of the city is about 50 billion rand, 55 billion rand, and you can see the split there between capital and operating, majority operating budget, and a staff complement of about 35,000 staff. And within that, there are is a water utility, a water and sanitation utility, an energy utility, solid waste, a transport function, a significant safety and security function, human settlements, etc. So this is a summary of the directorates within the city, and you can see that it's a complex organization with many complementary but distinct objectives that it needs to fulfill within each of these sectors. In terms of the city's characteristics, it's about 4.5 million people, 1.4 million households. And it's approximately 3.7 million people in formal residential housing, and about close to a million people in informal residential housing, in informal settlements, informal housing. And if we look forward, we know that if we look at the projected number of new dwelling units that will be needed over the next 20 years, and we look at the number of new housing opportunities that will require, and we look at what is being delivered currently, we know that there's a significant shortfall. If current supply remains the same, there's going to be a very significant shortfall, and the logical consequence of that is that you'll see a far greater share of informal houses in the future if there's not a significant shift in supply. Adnan, I trust that you will, or Jemima, you'll alert me if the slides are unclear at any point. But I assume it is clear. Thanks, Adnan. I can see you nodding. So it's hard to understate, as has been the case all over the world, the impact of COVID on Cape Town. It was already a highly unequal society. South Africa is a very unequal society, and that is true for Cape Town as well. In the 2020 economic impacts were significant. We had a almost 7% GDP contraction for 2020. We had an 8.5% decline in employment. On average, a 9% household income drop. But we know that average hides the reality that the least secure people with the least secure employment and the really most vulnerable were the ones who lost jobs quickest and never got them back, or were much slower to get them back as a result of the pandemic. The thinking about how to support economic recovery, but within using the levers that the city has, recognizing that the city's primary functions are basic service delivery, required us to think very carefully about using every lever we could pull. And the basic, thinking about, and I'll say this again later, but using the city's infrastructure budget fully and strategically is one of the most significant things that we concluded we could do to support recovery in Cape Town. So just to give you a sense of some of the challenges we face, and I think some of these are actually true of any metro in South Africa, but of many cities globally. So this is this complicated diagram is just to show you the timelines going from left to right in terms of years, and then the different bars are different strategies that have different timescales. All aiming to achieve objectives approved by council and in line with our constitutional commitments, but all having different timelines. And then you'll see down at the bottom there that we have a five-year electoral term. So we just actually just had local government elections, and today had a new mayor elected by council. And so we're entering into a new term of office, and you've got to align these long-term plans and long-term infrastructure needs with five-year political cycles. So that's one challenge. And that is challenging enough, and that's true anywhere in the world. But then you have these shocks that have, and even in the time that I've been in the city, I've experienced a 1 in 300 year drought that we had to navigate, and then about a year and a half later, COVID, and then on top of that, you know, ongoing stresses. I was just saying to Adnan as we were waiting to start the call that we're going through another round of what they call in South Africa load shedding, which is this managed power cuts to deal with a shortfall of power supply on the national grid. Then translating that strategy into an integrated portfolio of projects and programs is another challenge. And you know, you have your high level spatial strategy and your overall 5-year term of office plan. That's the MSDF and the IDP acronyms on the left there. And then those have to convert into planning assumptions and demand analysis, and then have to go into, you know, technically sound sector plans, whether it be the water engineer saying this is exactly what needs to happen for water supply or the equivalent for electricity that goes into a portfolio. And then all of that has to be funded, which has an impact then on what you need to recover from your property rates, tax and your tariffs. So challenge three is that you know, we face infrastructure constraints, and there's in some areas the infrastructure capacity is insufficient to support the desired level of development and the take up of development rights. So you have a spatial strategy that sets out, you know, where you would like to see the city densify, and you need to make sure that the infrastructure is able to support that densification. And then at the same time, you have a rapid expansion of the informal part of the city that isn't happening within the structured planning approvals of and development regime of the city. And that's been particularly the case in COVID, where many people who were suddenly overnight unemployed and were evicted from, you know, accommodation, for example, informal accommodation within the backyard of a formal home, and suddenly had to find new accommodation. You had significant numbers of new informal settlements springing up. The fourth challenge is delivering infrastructure in a highly regulated procurement environment. In South Africa, we have approximately 400 pieces of law or regulation that govern our procurement environment. And so, and you have a Financial Management Act that is safeguards against malpractice and corruption. But it is applied to a small municipality as well as a metro with all the complexity that Cape Town has. You need to create the appropriate institutional mechanism to support infrastructure delivery. So you have these line departments, and you have to respect it's important to respect the decision-making authority and accountability of the executive director who sits at the top of each one of these vertical stacks. And you have planning that happens within those, which is important because there's a discipline like electricity or water discipline that has a logic to it, and there's accountability. But you also have to be able to manage these trade-offs and choices across all of these portfolios. Builds on that point really, but is you have a spatial plan, you have to have an infrastructure plan that aligns to that, and then you've got to then integrate that with annual budgeting processes and choices that have to be made from one year to the next, and sustain that program and make sure that it realizes the overall spatial and economic and social objectives. So I just want to give a brief case study that's very, very real issue in Cape Town at the moment. And in South Africa, actually at large, but you know, in South Africa is facing a water quality crisis. We have billions of liters of insufficiently treated sewage, industrial and pharmaceutical wastewater that are discharged into South African rivers and oceans on a daily basis. And this, the charts on the left just shows the state of wastewater treatment in South Africa in terms of an assessment of wastewater treatment works. And 75% of the 910 municipal wastewater treatment works are less than 50% compliant to effluent standards. And so I don't think I need to explain to this audience what that the implications of that from a health point of view and an economic point of view, but it is significant. So in Cape Town, we have 26 municipal wastewater treatment works. The majority were built in the 50s and 60s. And for a variety of reasons, not just because of the wastewater treatment works, sometimes because, for example, stormwater infrastructure is incorrectly used, or there's a whole range of reasons. But there are a large number of sewage spills reported across the city, and there is most certainly a component of that which is due to maintenance needs. And just recently, where there are upgrades to wastewater treatment projects, works that are underway, they are large infrastructure projects, they're capital intensive, and they take time to plan, design, and construct. And it can take, 6 to 8 years for a capacity upgrade project to be completed. And just recently, because of delays, all for clear reasons, they've over the last 5 years, there's had to be a slowdown in development in a particular area of the city because of this wastewater treatment, a particular wastewater treatment work being behind and therefore insufficient bulk capacity. And you can imagine in a city that urgently needs more housing and needs as much economic activity as it can muster, that is a deep source of frustration and a lost economic opportunity. So there's two sort of very logical departure points for developing a framework. So what do you do about this? It's a complex environment. You want to improve the integration and the planning. You want to fulfill both your long-term commitments that are mandated by the elected democratic council. And you have your pre-existing pre-COVID challenges, and then you layered on top of that, you have the economic imperative, recovery imperative, and at the same time, you're dealing with the fiscal impacts of COVID on the city government in terms of revenues, and the ability to take financial risk, But one thing that we went into with this piece of work there was a huge advantage, is that we were building on existing efforts underway. So we have, good engineering capabilities and in many cases sound, engineering plans. And we have invested in our project and portfolio management capability and our engineering services. And we've invested in our data capabilities in the city over recent years. And in our economic analysis capabilities. So we had those capabilities to complement what our engineering, the longstanding expertise that our engineering colleagues and our spatial planning colleagues have. But we required a method to consider the trade-offs when making choices across different options. So I don't think I need to tell an audience of students and colleagues at the LSE why infrastructure is important economically, but just to say that it enables it's a form of economic stimulus and spending into the economy, but it does it's critical for boosting long-term productivity and enabling cities to achieve those development gains that we all know they have the potential to. And as I said, I think spending infrastructure budget fully and strategically is one of the primary levers that the city government has, given that many of the economic development functions and regulatory functions, for example, to reduce regulatory hurdles to businesses, are not within the city's gift. they are national competencies. So the aim was to establish an integrated long-term view of the infrastructure portfolio and to ensure a citywide strategic coordinated approach to infrastructure. And it was it really was a consolidation of efforts. And this just builds on what the comments I made earlier and reminds me, actually, there were other things that we'd made a big effort on, such as contract management, which is, you know, it may sound like bureaucratic detail, but, you know, to execute an infrastructure project well, you're going to be relying on contractors. And to do contract management well in a way that passes muster with the Auditor General is actually critical. Being able to make sure we'd built a system of implementation readiness assessments. So we systematically every year, then to all projects being put forward for potential funding in the budget are screened for project readiness. And that enables us to make sure that if a project goes onto the budget, it actually is able to spend. Because in South African metros, as anywhere, you're underspending on a capital budget is obviously a significant problem, particularly where you are charging the ratepayer or the consumer of a service a fee for using that service, and that's built on a planned capital budget. You have to make sure that you're ready to spend and able to spend that capital budget well. So what was in the scope of this? What did we, as we began down this road, begin to set out as the key components of the strategy? Well, the first is to have a consolidated 10-year portfolio. So there are two components that are important there. One is that it's not just a siloed sector by sector view, but it's all a view of all the sectors. And then a 10-year view. So in some sectors, this involves really stretching out the project pipeline so that we can get a clearer view for long-term financial planning and project preparation effort. Then to introduce a way of, you know, obviously, ultimately, the decisions will be made on many criteria, and an engineering assessment is obviously critical in terms of what is priority. But we wanted to put in place a prioritization method that allowed us to consider a number of different criteria to support decision making. So this is not some sort of automated decision making system. It's a support to the executive mayor, who has to recommend the budget and the portfolio to council. And but critically, learning lessons from previous efforts was to put in place a delivery mechanism. And that had three components: a delivery focus, so getting alongside key projects with support in whether it be on procurement or project preparation or contract management or any other aspect. And then a strategic focus, so enabling strategic improved strategic planning, alignment, analysis, and monitoring, and some serious problem solving. And then a program of regulatory reform and advocacy, recognizing that there are critical components of the infrastructure fabric of Cape Town, which are not within the city's control to execute, and passenger rail being like a great example, but there, which is we have fewer passengers on our trains in Cape Town now, and fewer train sets than we had 10 years ago, because of challenges faced in the state-owned enterprise that runs passenger rail. But there are other areas as well, where, you know, in just critical highway interchanges, etc., that are run by a separate agency. And then strategic considerations around dependencies and financing options, et cetera. So I showed this diagram earlier, but this infrastructure approach tries to bring these isolated portfolios together into a consolidated view that allows us to understand impact and risk of sector choice across the different sectors as a whole portfolio. This is just an example. This is not this is just a sample and at a point in time. But this is a sample of top 40 projects by value. And really, I don't want to get into the detail of this, and I know the text is very small on your screens, but it's just to show you that the diversity of choices. And if you just look at the left-hand column, you'll see that there are major enabling software and IT upgrades. There are transport investments, water and sanitation, human settlements investments, things like a stadium upgrade. There are informal trading support infrastructure, broadband, electricity related projects, etc. So the scope of this is critical, and we up till now have not had a systematic way of considering trade-offs between these choices. This is just to give you a sense of the 10-year portfolio, which is about 2,500 projects across with the different directorates, and then we classified. You can see the major ones are the three blue ones, which is transport, the corporate services, which is the enabling broadband ICT infrastructure that we're having to invest in right now, and then water and waste. And then you can see we try to categorize that infrastructure on basic infrastructure, so infrastructure for basic services, infrastructure that supports economic activity very explicitly, and then institutional. And that just gives you a sense of the split. So the prioritization was only made possible. So you can only prioritize a consolidated portfolio if the content is there for each sector. And so what we did is invested very heavily in making sure that we had a standardized set of sector plans across all of the sectors. And it sounds really obvious, but making sure everyone was using the same planning assumptions, same population projections, economic projections, and spatial land use model, and then stretching out where necessary that portfolio of projects further into the future, and just bringing some standardization to this, and making sure that each of those sector plans went through the right authorizing authority in terms of going to our executive team and our city manager. And these will be reviewed and improved over time, but they provided the basis to populate their portfolio. And then we set out with quite grand ambitions on terms of the different types of analysis we wanted to do on the portfolio, but ended up, for reasons of data, reasons of limited staff capacity, settling on four key criteria. And they were project readiness and preparation assessment. So project readiness is applied to the near-term view, 1 to 3 years, and project assessment, preparation assessment to the outer years. So, has that project started going through the preparation steps as you would expect 5 years out from implementation, for example. Spatial alignment, which is critical. I mean, it's critical for any city, but it's particularly important in South Africa because we have to address the legacy of apartheid spatial planning. And there's a spatial strategy for the city, and we score projects against their alignment to that. And then strategic alignment, which is a qualitative assessment, but basically says how well aligned is this project to the strategic priorities of council. And then finally, economic benefit is the first time we've ever done this in any form, but is to try and assess the economic benefits of any given infrastructure project. And that's both in terms of direct investment benefits, the economic activity it might enable, and then the job opportunities it could create. And that this is, I would say, that economic benefit assessment is very much a work in progress. We know it's incomplete, but it's what we had the tools to use at the time. And we're actually in progress of building some spatial economic models that will, with collaborators that Adnan will know well, to try and give us tools to assess particular economic benefits of particular infrastructure choices. This is just speaking about the methodology of the economic scoring, but I won't go into that in detail in the interest of time, and the same for the strategic criteria. The spatial scoring is pretty straightforward in that there's a spatial overlay, and our colleagues have written code where, as long as we have the geotagged location of projects, which is pretty straightforward for a point project, then we can score it. Gets more complex when you have to say what is the area of benefit of a wastewater treatment plant, for example, where the location of the plant is less important than the area of benefits or serves. Backlogs was an area that we wanted to do quite a lot on, and we really feel like we've just scratched the surface and there's lots to do more to do on this. But the first thing to do was to get a standardized language across the city on what do we mean by backlogs. Do you know that people have different meanings, and we've learned that people understood that differently. So we identified three different backlogs that we wanted to focus on: investment backlogs, replacement backlogs, maintenance backlogs. And then we brought those insights from the line departments and the technical experts together with views from, for example, spatial analysis and what we see as where we know there are constraints to development that our colleagues in development management see when they consider building plans, for example. And then we also brought in data analysis that was being done by a data science team to, for example, using the customer fault reporting data to try and identify where there are hotspots, and then do root cause analysis of saying what's going on in that area, why are there so many fault reports there, to try and understand causes. And so we really have started on a journey, and there's much more to do of using various data sources to then identify areas that require root cause analysis that then leads to the identification of a project that could address that. For example, repeated sewer overflows in a particular area. You understand that it's a pipe that needs to be replaced, or some sort of component of the wastewater treatment system that's failing, and or a pump station that's repeatedly vandalized, or whatever it is that leads to a project in identification, and then you build that into the plan. And some of those things hopefully are things that we can do quickly to address immediate customer needs, but some of those will be long-term investments, and then we need to make sure those go into the plan and are considered for budgeting. This is social benefit is something that we wanted to consider much more in the original sort of scoring matrix, but we didn't have the capability to do it, and that's something that we'll be working on. But what we have done for now is used a socioeconomic vulnerability viewer, spatial viewer of the city that draws on various data sources and uses polygons laid over the city to project it and visualize it. And we lay over the infrastructure projects, geotagged infrastructure projects on that. And we'll use that as part of the decision support, but it's something that we want to develop further. And this is just an example of a sort of deep, more detailed view where you see particular projects on a socioeconomic layer, that where obviously the darker colors is greater levels of socioeconomic vulnerability. So, and then one of the obvious things that we have to do in our analysis of the portfolio is to understand, and this comes from our specialist portfolio analysts, who need to adjust the portfolio based on, you might have an ideal plan in multiple sectors based on need, but if that leads to a spike in projects in a particular year that's not going to be able to fit through the procurement pipeline, or there are dependencies, it's a housing development, you need water and a road and sewer lines all put in to make the housing development work. That sort of analysis then allows you to say, okay, we realistically need to rephase and rebalance this portfolio. And obviously financial considerations come in there as well, because there's only so much budget the city can raise and spend within any given year. And so I think this is just a slide to say that you could think of this approach to infrastructure portfolio management as a form of risk management, because it allows decision makers to with some support from analysts to be able to assess risks and understand the risks that they are taking across portfolios. So I'm moving into the sort of final part of my presentation, but it's obviously important to, you can have fantastic plans and you can know where the risks are and you can understand where the needs are, but delivery is really what matters. And we are putting in place, and this is, so, if we talk in a year's time, I'll be able to tell you how this has gone, but we're putting in place an infrastructure delivery team that is going to get alongside the line department that's responsible for a given function and provide support to key projects where there's a particular challenge or risk. There's an infrastructure strategy team, which is the one that I will lead with colleagues of mine across the city, which is going to support that portfolio analysis and bring together the outputs into the annual strategic and budgeting process, and then also do an annual review and an annual report on the infrastructure in Cape Town. That is the goal. And then when those technical updates are needed to the sector plans to adjust to new needs, or indeed new, as we face, going into a new term of office, new political direction, that team will facilitate that. And then this infrastructure advocacy and reform component that will identify policy issues and project issues that are outside of the city's control, and then make sure that we have a systematic approach to seeing those change. So this is a very busy diagram, but let me just say that on the left you have high level strategy for the city that converts into sector specific set plans, like an energy plan or a water plan, that leads into a pipeline that has different time horizons. And what the infrastructure strategy that I've been talking through does is pull those all together into a 10-year view that then supports delivery and has a strategic analysis component. And then needs to, once a particular budget has been approved and there's a selection of projects in there, we'll then need to feed that back into the analysis for the next round. And just to say that, institutionally, this needs to be managed, well, because it's essential that the line function within a city government remains responsible and accountable and able to deliver on its core functions, whether that be for example transport. But you need to be able to put these transversal teams or these cross-cutting teams together to be able to support and make sure that organizational strategy overall is delivered. So what lessons have we learned in closing? So in developing the framework, and we had an advisor walking the journey with us from the World Bank, and it was really interesting to get his experience because he had worked all over the world in the EU and China and in countries of vastly different income, per capita incomes. And it's clear that, Cape Town is kind of, we had challenges and tools from both, rich country context and a poorer developing country context. So there was no exact model for us to follow. But we figured out something that we think works for us, and we will adapt it as we go. But it's clear a few key things lessons are clear even at this early stage. So one is the importance of having a committed leadership champion, both at the political level, and the mayor was very supportive and the new mayor is supportive as well. And at the administrative level, the support of the city manager, and then critically, the executive director who was responsible for it at the time, Craig Kesson, gave clear leadership support. And then I think very early on, realizing that, trying to go for a selection of projects was not going to work. We had to look at the system and support, the competencies and abilities in the system, but address the challenges. And so taking that systems view, which is complex, and I'm sure you've got a taste of it through the slides that I've presented, but it was important to embrace that and to try and work with that complex system. But then, also not try and overcomplicate it. And I think a multi-criteria analysis, was a good example of that, of having quite grand ambitions to include resilience analysis and all these things that we'd love to understand, but then ultimately saying, actually, this boils down to potential socioeconomic benefit and spatial alignment. And even on that, we're probably going to refine it further, and I'll speak to that in the next slide. And then this reflection that infrastructure strategies, that is it a process systems approach, which we've gone through for, or is it a list of projects? We will ultimately produce a list of projects every year for decision makers to choose, but it's not a once-off. This is our top 40 projects, big bang, done. And then just working with our existing capacity and capability and all the investments and enhancements that have been made in the city probably over the last decade, and really putting those to work, whether it be the data science team or the engineering unit or the detailed planning within a given department, like, you know, the water department, who survived, you know, led us through the drought and learned many valuable lessons there and have developed a long-term plan to augment our water supply. So it was working with all of those. And then really working with a cross-disciplinary team and being very respectful of disciplinary expertise. And then obviously quality data and data management is crucial. Cape Town's made huge progress over the last 5 years, 4 or 5 years on our data strategy and being able to use administrative data from one function collected for a particular purpose for a broad range of other purposes, but we still have a long way to go on that. And then creating a framework that allows for improvement over time. We don't think for a second that we have achieved where we've got to, but it's a slightly overused term, but it's a maturity journey. So, you know, we know that we're building systems and to improve our project preparation over time, for example, but we need to build a framework that allows for that journey. And in terms of implementation, we're early days still. I think, you know, it's obvious to say, but portfolio assessment is only as good as information provided by the project managers. You know, practical things like the geocodes of projects and the area of benefit of a particular investment, you know, like a water project, what area of the city does it benefit? And then being very clear on the reasons and goals of a project, which again might sound self-evident, but it isn't. The linkage between the strategy of the city and the objective of the project are not always clear. And then also being clear on the benefits. So as we improve that data at the project input level, then it'll open up more and more opportunities for portfolio assessment. And then scoring via the multi-criteria analysis, I think. There are a number of things that we can reflect on there, and we're going with the current methodology, but I think that over time, and on advice of actually coming out of a conversation with Professor Ed Glazer, I think we may well change that methodology to focus primarily on socioeconomic benefit and then discount projects that don't spatially align or that are not project ready. We'll need to test that and evolve it over time. But I think the multi-criteria analysis is a huge step forward now, but we want to improve it over time. And then just again, in implementation, the value of identifying multiple sources of data and having multidisciplinary teams working together. And you know, our challenge now and going into this new term of office and into a new calendar year next year, we'll be building that sense of momentum and demonstrating value from this new approach early on. So let me stop there and take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. It was great. You presented an excellent framework. You also shared more of a systems view where you not only discussed and listed different components of a city governance and infrastructure and planning strategy, but also their linkages. So I thought it was great. Let's now open up to questions. I will start with a couple of questions and comments of my own. My colleague, Vanessa, may have some. I'm sure others are getting ready to also jump into the discussion. Let me start with the first call it comment or a question. So you presented an excellent framework, as I mentioned. And as we all know, city planning or planning of any type can be a force for the good in coordinating the actions of different actors. And in terms of like externality, in other words, there is an economic logic to planning. Excessive planning can also be bad, can backfire. We know from lots of work, historical example, but also James Scott, Seeing Like the State, all kinds of examples from Africa and elsewhere. So maybe going further from your framework, can you share maybe one specific example of where policy analysis, ideally economic policy analysis, either change a particular decision or that the city government took, or maybe generated insights into a decision that would not otherwise have been possible?
Thank you, Adnan. So you're right about excessive planning and being unhealthy for sure. And I think that's a critical balance that we have to maintain going through this process. And I think in general, in South Africa, we need to, it's true, you know, for example, I've often heard it, I think Professor Paul Collier often speaks about one of the challenges in urban development in Africa is that you have, British town planning regimes that were kind of frozen in time when there was a independence in many African countries, and how inappropriate those have been for the development of African cities. And so I think one of the challenges in Cape Town, and I'm sorry, there's a slight separate point to your question, but is, we have two very different cities. We have a quite informal city and a formal city, and then we have a city that's in between and mixed. And we need to adjust our planning regimes and our development facilitation to support all those different parts of the city, so that every neighborhood is a pathway to improved accommodation and services. So I think if I think of particular decisions that have changed, so that we've had an impact on. So right now we are in the process of developing a cost benefit analysis methodology for the city. When I came in and we started doing some project assessments, so we introduced something, we actually borrowed something from the UK government called the five case model, which is a structured way of building up the case for a major project. And it starts with a strategic case and a socioeconomic case. And when we did our first ones of those on major projects, like big projects, like a major BRT investment, it became clear that over time, different consultants have been brought in to do different socioeconomic assessments, but using different methodologies, looking at different data sets, different parameters, and that what we really needed was a consistent city approach to doing cost-benefit analysis, acknowledging that CBAs to some extent are tailored for every single project that you look at, because every project is different. But so we have developed this methodology and are now applying it to considering large-scale desal. But also, you know, a recent opportunity came up to consider hosting a major event in Cape Town that involved some infrastructure investment in order to allow the event to proceed. And the team were able to do a rapid cost-benefit analysis that enabled the political leadership to make an informed decision about the potential return on that on the infrastructure investment that was needed, and the potential benefits of that event economically. So I think that's an example one example on the sort of economics analysis side, and then there are, you know, others, for example, on water, that my team worked very closely with our water colleagues coming out of the drought to frame up a water strategy that would guide us forward. And that water strategy is now being used to, as a driver to then look at utility reform, tariff reform, and to crowding international partners to support the future development of the water utility. And then on broadband, for example, some analysis and support from my team and others helped us to come up with a much more refined approach to the broadband rollout in Cape Town, one that was more financially sustainable and was very, very clear about our value add in a telecom sector that had changed drastically since those investments first started, and thought about socioeconomic benefits and brought some some more clarity on what the exact parameters were of that investment. So those are some examples. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Hugh. So my next question is along similar lines: the challenges of planning at a city level in a multi-tier government structure, federal government structure. Cape Town is one city. And how does one plan when there are externalities and spillovers across different governments, and when some of the key parameters are decided by, say, higher level governments, state and central governments, and where One is also like at a city level, it's partly responding to exogenous policies by other governments, but partly some of those responses could also be endogenous or internal or generated by your own actions. In other words, like if you provide better services, there could be in-migration, there could be increase in size of the city. So how do you deal with the, like, how do you think of those issues at Cape Town?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the exogenous factors that impact on us is almost easier to answer. So I'll answer that first. So in Cape Town, I think our response to that, and look, this is very real for us. You know, and I gave rail as an example, but there are other aspects of transport, you know, the performance of the port, investments in road. There's a major critical transport link in one part of the city, a rail line that was supposed to be built that is kind of a critical piece of the spatial strategy and the transport strategy that just hasn't materialized. And then, of course, there's the load shedding, the energy blackouts that I mentioned. There are many others, whether it be land release, there's large pieces of land in the city that are used by the defense force or not held by the defense force, but not actively used and would be prime for human settlements development, housing development. So on those things, I think our approach to it is to work collaboratively wherever possible. So at a sort of technical level, there's maximum collaboration between officials, between spheres of government. And so this is true in the water, for example, bulk water supply and catchment management are critical to Cape Town, but are within national government control. It's true on critical transport projects as well, and in the energy sector. But so there's that level of cooperation. I think in this going to this new term, there'll be a significant effort on this as a really strategic approach to sustained, almost like advocacy effort over years with national government, for example, on big strategic issues and infrastructure investments. And that needs to consider a full range of options. And, you know, at times the city has been combative, using legal action. And at times it's been, you know, very, very collaborative. And I think all of those approaches need to be considered. And then, I think most importantly for the city, it's focusing on what we can do within our control. And that is about focusing on the core services that we need to do better and are within our control, whether that be water and sanitation or transport or human settlements or community services, or whether it's even challenging, you know, moving into areas where we just want to try and move to a different model. And I think that is going to become increasing. Our new mayor has made significant commitments on energy about moving away from the status quo system where we were highly reliant on national government supply. So I think that, you know, it's both about trying to proactively bring about change from other spheres of government, but also just taking more control of what we can ourselves and make sure that we do the basics right. There are many areas where we need to improve. And so we need to kind of almost get our house in order first. So I think that's one response. In terms of the endogenous factors, I mean, obviously the point about population growth is true, and that's not something that I don't think the city bemoans. You know, that's it's not something that there's no sort of intent to underinvest in services, for example, to try and prevent migration. Certainly not. But I think probably a bigger factor is just, dealing with our own organizational complexity and our own budget trade-offs, probably being the biggest sort of endogenous factors. And then obviously the needs and aspirations of very different communities across the city is something that we have to manage as well. So I don't know if that answers your question, Adnan, but it's my best shot right now.
Thank you, Hugh. It does. So let's open up. So sorry to hear about your technical issues, Vanessa. You can come into the conversation anytime, but to give you some time to reflect, unless you want to come in right now, let's start with Ashutosh, who has been waiting for a long time. Over to you, Ashutosh. Why don't you introduce yourself and then share your comment or question.
Sure. Thanks, Professor. And thanks you for such a wonderful presentation. You covered quite a bit. It was very informative. I'm Ashutosh, second year MP student, and I come from India. I had like a sort of a similar question to what Professor had asked, but like a bit more specific in a sense that I wanted to understand a bit more about how the informal settlements are sort of viewed by the corporation. Because for instance, I've worked with Delhi government, and Delhi is a city where like 70% of the settlements are sort of informal, or like the way we call it in Delhi are like sort of unauthorized. So just wanted to sort of understand how big of a challenge is that, not just in terms of infrastructure, but also politically, because a lot of times these the way these settlements are dealt with becomes a huge political issue. So just wanted to understand a bit more about the present settlements, how big of a challenge is that, and B, also to sort of understand what's like the government's view on like the future sort of migration and future sort of potential informal settlements that might come in, like how does the government plan about them?
So thanks for the question, and highly relevant. And I think so the first thing is, you know, how does the government view informal settlements? So I think it's been an established view, not just in Cape Town, I think in South Africa for some time, that we need to accept that informality is not a temporary feature. You know, it's not something that we can't pretend that all of these areas are going to, you know, those people are going to ultimately move into a state provided formal house, because you probably know that after democracy in South Africa, there was a massive program of public home building and state provided homes. And I think that there was a period of time where people thought, well, informality is just a holding position until people can get formal homes. And I think there is a, you know, so you often hear it said in sort of urban discourse in South Africa that, you know, we need to own up to and accept that informality is a permanent feature now, and we need to respond to it appropriately. So it's one thing to say that, and it's another thing to do it. I think in Cape Town, there's been an immense effort to make sure that there's high quality services as possible to informal settlements across the city. So we have very high levels of access to water, sanitation, and electricity in informal settlements across the city. The places that aren't supplied with those basic services, and those are free basic services. So there's a free basic allocation of water and electricity to households, and then people only start paying above a certain threshold. So there's a high level of accessibility. The only places that aren't serviced are places that are where the land is encumbered for some reason, like private land, or it's in a floodplain or under power lines, or there's some reason why the services can't be provided there. That said, there is significant challenge from civil society. We're a very active civil society in Cape Town who citizens themselves, who do challenge the city government on the quality of service provision. And so, you know, for example, sanitation is a constant source of tension in terms of what sanitation options are possible in an informal settlement, where rights of way and infrastructure, pathways for infrastructure installation have not been kept open, or they're basically built on almost like sand dunes that are very unstable. And so your sanitation options there are not, you know, it's not waterborne sanitation options, and that has always been a source of challenge. So the intention in Cape Town, and there's no doubt that we aspire to do much better, is to invest heavily in informal settlement upgrade, but also to start more actively exploring, you know, what has been used in other parts of the world, which is managed settlements. So that's accepting that certain pieces of land are going to be informal and putting in place the bulk infrastructure and protecting rights of way, etc., as those places are then people settle in those places, but with informal housing. So, and then I think to recognize that there's another phenomenon in South Africa, and I don't know if this is the case in Delhi, for example, but is formal neighborhoods that have a significant formal informal component. And I referenced it briefly, but this is where someone has a home and then they build an informal structure in the back, or two or three informal structures in the back, to rent them out. And those are in demand because they're often better quality houses and in better quality locations with more access to opportunities and amenities. And so another challenge for the city government is how to properly service those neighborhoods and that are growing rapidly, but not through formal development. And so that's about making sure we understand and count that the nature of growth in those areas, and then be able to properly factor those into service delivery plans. So one of the things that's in our, and if you're interested in this, it's available, I think it's available on our city website, but we have a new human settlement strategy for Cape Town. So it's been approved this year by our council. And that also seeks to, where the intention there is to pilot something called a local planning support office, which would seek to shift our development management rules and regulations from a regulation stance to a support stance, to say, we know that in parts of the city, there are people taking an informal home built out of metal and wood and putting a second story on it, then, and then creating rooms either for family members or to rent out for income. And instead of, you know, pretending that's not happening or trying to enforce, compliance on particular, you know, measures that are designed for formal neighborhoods, let's have kind of off-the-shelf building plans that can help people to work with micro developers to expand their homes and to formalize more easily. So that is one of the components of our new human settlement strategy, that is a strategy of council.
Okay, thanks. Vanessa, do you want to come into the discussion now? I hope your technical issues have been resolved for now.
They have. Thank you so much. I just lost contact at some point, but I'm back here. So thank you, Hugh, for such an interesting presentation, for such a thorough view on the way you provide these services and the decision-making process that entails all of these provision of projects and infrastructure. I was wondering, I have a very specific question and then a larger question. The more specific one is, you spoke about the sources of income for you to develop all of these projects, both at the local level, no, so local taxes and local services, and also revenues from the federal budget. What is the proportion? I was just wondering, how does this play out in the larger funding of all of these projects, like local and federal? And my broader question would be, if you can give us more taste around, you described very well, and I was quite impressed about the prioritization process you have on determining which of the projects go ahead, and it's very strict, and it's very, you follow a certain methodology. But if you can take us more to the political aspects and the political constraints you have, when you have that methodology and when you design that, and when you contrast that with reality and with political cycles and political pressures, and more the political economy aspects of this. So how you manage to be the catalyzing box that at the same time has the all the methodology to do the assessment for the prioritization of the projects, but at the same time, all the constraints that you face to make the decisions and to implement the decisions themselves. So if you can take us to some of the elements that how it's like to be in that decision making process. And thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa. So sources of funding, I'll take that one first. So the majority of the city's income comes from property taxes, so we call those rates, and tariffs. So that's tariff funded services. So the bulk is from, you know, the sale of electricity, sale of water, waste collection, and then property taxes. As I said, the share of the federal tax, the national government tax income is quite a small percentage. I don't know the figure off the top of my head. but it's a relatively small percentage. Grants are very important, but they are, then those, so those come from the national budget, and but they are conditional, and so we have to work with whatever the national policy is, and there are often real constraints around that. So, for example, you may want to start to build publicly provided homes that cater from the beginning for backyarding. For people, people are going to put up, want to accommodate tenants or family members in their backyard, and so it would make sense to build a home from scratch that is suitable for that. Or you may say, we do have a very stated clear objective in our spatial strategy, but also in most South African cities, of densifying to make public transport more viable and all the other benefits that come from a more compact city or more dense city. So, but the grant conditions don't allow for double story homes, for example. And there are other examples than that, but the grant funding is really important, for example, for our BRT line extension at the moment, for example. But we know that that's going to be under pressure into the future. So and we know even, for example, on electricity, that the margins, and this has been a big source of funding for a lot of South African municipalities in the past, but going forward with the amount of tariff increases that the national energy utility needs to ask for to keep going because it's so deeply in debt and in financial crisis, that leaves no room for the city to put on to get extra revenue from electricity sales. So all of that just means that I think that the financial, so I give that detail to really paint the picture for Vanessa of a financial picture which is changing quite rapidly. And to which the city is having to adapt. So I think that national grants, as the national fiscus is under pressure, there's a possibility that those will be under pressure as well. And then we have to obviously recognize the economic hardship that the residents of Cape Town are feeling in the wake of COVID. And so that means that you have to maintain rates and tariffs at a certain level. And so all of that makes spending, firstly setting an infrastructure budget that's realistic to start with, and not being in a situation as happens in sometimes where you might budget for spending 9 billion rand a year on infrastructure, but actually in the mid-year adjustment, it's adjusted down to 6 billion because that's what you can get through the pipe, the pipeline. So it's about being realistic about that, and then about spending infrastructure, making really smart choices about it. I think there's also a question about financing. Leveraging the budget sheet. Cape Town does do that quite actively and has a good credit rating, although it's been impacted by the national credit rating. But we do use that actively, and that will be important going forward. So that's one source of funding. On the politics of the decision-making, from my personal experience, Vanessa, I haven't had a very normal time in the city because in my experiences of budget decision-making process in the city have been through two major crises. And so, both the water crisis and COVID. And in there, I think the clear tension that our political decision makers have to face, and it's incredibly hard, is how do you prioritize the drought response and the emergency water augmentation and derail everything that you promised the electorate you would do when you came into office, and not derail, but like rephase it into the future, which means delayed improvements to transport access in the city, for example. But you're facing a drought, so you need to put money into water augmentation, for example. And then in COVID, it was about, making sure that we could continue to deliver the infrastructure commitments we already had, even though many contractors were not able to function properly, etc. But also then recognizing that there were many, many other new spending requirements that had to be prioritized. And a really good example now is the tension of long-term water diversification. So we need to diversify our water supply in the light of climate change and the likelihood of another severe drought. But that is expensive, and there are other pressures. And so one of the trade-offs that our new mayor will have to make is about, do you push that water augmentation investment out and to prioritize other investments now, with the risk that should we have another, should a 1 in 300 year drought actually become a 1 in 20 year drought, you know, what situation will we be in? So, and I think from an official point of view, our approach is always to say, look, we'll do the analysis and we'll present the choices, but ultimately it's up to, you know, it's a political decision-making process. And so, you know, priorities about, you know, areas that need to be prioritized or particular sectors that need to be prioritized or the tolerance for a particular rates and tariff increase that might be imposed on the residents, those all have to be factored into the political decision making. And so we can interact with that, we can advise, but ultimately, you know, it's those democratically elected representatives who have to make those calls. One thing I do think that we can do much better as civil servants is make those decisions easier, because it's in the City of Cape Town budgets, those are all of our major infrastructure projects actually directly visible on our budgets. And, you know, come to budget time, you know, it's putting an infrastructure, putting a massive spreadsheet in front of a decision maker is, and asking them to make choices is time consuming and difficult. And I think creating tools that allow decision makers to look at different lenses and weigh up different benefits is part of what we're trying to do.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Vanessa and Hugh. Over to others. Who wants to ask the next question? While you're thinking, maybe let me ask you a general question to you. Maybe first part of it, you already mentioned things where you succeeded and what you learned from them. But maybe also things where initiatives where which didn't work out, but you also learned something from them and maybe you can share your insights in a way that will be useful for all future policy practitioners who are attending this talk. You're on mute, Hugh.
Sorry, apologies. Relating specifically to infrastructure, Adnan?
Yes, but maybe broadly, maybe more generally as well.
I think probably a lesson that I've learned is about, you know, particularly when you work in a sort of central function like mine, which is, a strategy, disciplines of strategy and economics and policy, and you work across the span of the organization. Just the learning to work with in a way that respects domain expertise, and really, you know, you being humble about the many, many, many things you do not know about, you know, a particular technical area. And being able to really work with that domain expertise and support those who really do have deep experience and knowledge, but then also be able to really confidently bring the skills that your team has, you know, and you know, whether it be strategy formulation or policy drafting or economic analysis or even just an external strategic challenge function to ask, you know, hard questions, and to bring, you know, or to improve the structure of, you know, planning pipelines, for example, planning documents. So I think that's been a lesson and one that I've enjoyed immensely, actually, as when you come, from, if you're curious about and interested in public policy challenges, working in a city government, like in the way that South African cities are structured, is fascinating, because the breadth of challenges that you can work, you know, that we have to deal with is immense. So I think that's probably a sort of broad a broad challenge. And then I think the other one is about time and how long change takes. And so I think, and you will know this, Adnan, very well from your experience in the civil service, but that being able to hold a long-term goal in mind and be able to year in, year out, work towards that and take some hits along the way. Sometimes they deserve it and that wasn't a good idea and you shouldn't have pursued that. But other times it's just a process of organizational change and there's gonna be some resistance. And so It's about knowing which of those to seed on and which of those to push through on. But just, I think for me, realizing it's a journey and having a long-term view on that change, I think has been a learning process for me. But the last few years have not been, it's been no plain sailing, because we've had two really transformational crises in the time that I've been in the city.
Very well put, you.
Hope that helps.
Very well put to you. Thanks. Yasmin Kuvadia, I hope I'm pronouncing your name
rightly. You are. She's a former colleague of mine, actually.
Okay. Yasmin, why don't
She's
you...
She's bound to ask me something vexingly difficult.
You better deliver on this.
No, I'm going to surprise you this evening. Sorry, I know we're on from different parts of the world. So I'm Yasmin. I'm here in my capacity as being a current student on the executive masters in cities. Just started and really enjoying it. So mine is not so much a question to you, but basically a compliment and an observation. I think what Hugh was very strong with is keeping to his process. And Hugh, it was very nice to hear from you that the process that you ran to get the infrastructure strategy together, to be able to get to the projects, the portfolio of projects, is important. You even refer to it now in your last statements as part of the journey. And I think that's what a lot of our other South African cities miss out on. Every year they get caught in this rat race to say, what are our priority projects? What are we funding? And they retrofitted back to the strategy and to the council priorities, etc. So having been an observer for many years, watching what the city of Cape Town has been doing, I thought that your commitment to the process is something that stood out to me. And I think we underestimate that. So all too often, something comes in, whether it's COVID, whether it's day zero for water, and it's easy to push that process away, but you're stuck to it. The second point I want to make is our planning system. So as much as it is British and so unsuitable for the current challenges that we face, we're still forced to put up with that. So dealing with informality and managing these areas, you do an initial layout because it's organic and you're trying to re-block and you're doing a whole lot of different things. When it comes to the time to have the township registered, things have changed, but we still stick to that. I mean, I don't understand why, and I'm not so much a statutory planner, so maybe I need to get in there and try it out, but it's totally inappropriate for the reality that we face on the ground, and the cost of it is extraordinary. And so people go and do backyard dwellings themselves. It's good that the city acknowledges that and supports that now, but it would have been totally illegal if we just looked at it from a planning system. So there's something wrong with our planning system. Thanks.
Excellent comments, Yasmin. So you definitely lived up to our expectation. So over to you. Yeah. You have any comments?
Yasmin, it's lovely to hear from you. And Yasmin worked at National Treasury and was one of the people that guided us and challenged us across the metros. So she has deep insights, not just from Cape Town. But so I think your point, the point about the process, so thank you for the compliment, Yasmin. And makes me think of the challenge of having internal capacity versus using consultants. Because I think a lot of this infrastructure planning in South Africa, I can't speak for other countries, but I think it's true in many countries, is that it's quite consultant reliant. So you don't necessarily have the skills inside the city administration. So you contract in the services and you get a good once-off product. Hopefully you get a good once-off product But then what happens in the next year and the next year and the year after that as circumstances change? And those infrastructure plans very quickly gather dust and no longer become, you know, live. And you don't, you're not changing the organizational systems and processes. And so I think that there is a lot to be said for building an internal capacity. And you can't do that. It's expensive, you know, staffing capacity is expensive and getting the right people in is not easy, but choosing the right areas and then capacitating that and really going for it. On particular critical issues seems to me to be critically important. And then that planning regime, the regulatory regime, Yasmin, I think you're absolutely spot on. And I heard our incoming mayor talk about in a meeting recently about the two types of, the two types of economy in Cape Town. And, you know, you have this kind of an economy that could rival, you know, the most technologically advanced, you know, economies in Europe or the States, for example, and then an economy that is comparable to, you know, some of the poorest, least developed parts of the world. And our planning regime is fit for one and not for the other. And so I think within the rules and regulations, the ambition for this new term of office is to try and implementing our strategy is to try and work with that informality and support it more, recognizing states can't build enough houses. And the private sector, the informality is a market response. It's a market response to housing need. It's a private sector response to a market failure, I guess is the right way to put it. And we need to recognize that and work with it.
Well, we have run the clock. This was an excellent session. So I think all of us learned quite a lot. It was both enjoyable, but also we learned quite a lot. So thank you very much. Very insightful for sharing your insights. Thank you very much, you. Let's give you a round of applause. Thank you, Hugh. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Adnan, and thank you all. Thanks for your time.